We're listening to Laura Erickson. We have Harry Hutchins and John Richardson with us this morning, and we're talking all things birds. John, I'd like to turn to you for a minute. I detect an accent that's not based in Minnesota. Give me a little bit of a background. Where did you originate, and what brought you to birds?
Oh, well, I was fortunate to, as some of you can remember, growing up with four TV channels and in England, watching BBC and David Attenborough. And I was absolutely fascinated with the birds of paradise in Papua New Guinea. And that was my spark. I still haven't been, by the way, but one day. That was my spark. And it's I was lucky that we have an abundance of birds on the east coast of England, East Yorkshire, and lots of seabirds and great migration. So, and then I moved over here 20-something years ago, and somehow here I am counting migration. It's a strange thing, but I'm not Australian. If I had a dollar for every time I got asked if I was Australian.
So, John, are you heading up the education program over there at Hawk Ridge, or?
So I'm the fall count director. So I take charge of the count, the researching of the migration, the counting. So there's myself, and then there'll be three other people, two interns and a counter, that'll be working with me. And I'm fortunate to have one of our interns back from last year, Nick Pulsatieri, who's from New York. He will be getting in his car, leaving from New York tomorrow, I believe.
He's a literal migrant worker.
Yeah. He's a great guy. And I said last year, I said, if you want to come back, and then we always get a couple of interns if we can. And got two really nice people, one from Illinois, one from down in the cities. And they're new out of college, really great girls, actually. So I'm excited to have them. So I take care of the count. The education side of things is going to be a little bit more tricky this year because, of course, we're normally doing a lot of school groups. And a lot of, little trips and education classes. We have the outdoor classroom there, which is because of COVID, it's going to be a little bit more of a challenge. And then Frank Nicoletti, he takes care of we stick him out in the woods. He's out in the woods doing the banding program. And some people don't realize that at Hawk Ridge, we have the world's largest raptor banding operation. We band around 4,000 raptors, hawks, and owls. We go 24 hours. We're banding hawks in the day, we're banding owls at night. So there's always something going on.
So, John, can school? I always brought a school group. I taught at the community college, and we come over every year and have some kind of educational venue set up there at Hawk Ridge. And is that going to happen this year?
In some capacity. I'm really being vague here because we're still trying to nail down, the things keep changing by the day. The kids are going back to school. Now they're not going back to school. Some colleges will be. But what I would do is, if anybody is interested, is Margie Menzies, who runs the education side of things, is to just go hawkridge.org and contact us, and we can certainly see what we can do to accommodate anybody that wants to come. So it's going to be a different year, unfortunately.
John, I just got this text message from a fellow traveler. He says, "I guessed East Yorkshire. I am from the West Yorkshire, and my brother lives in Hull. I also get pegged as being from Australia." So you've got a fellow traveler out there, John.
Well, that's funny because the city I grew up in is Hull as well. So we're from the same city.
Apparently your accent gave you away. I love it. Say, John, I want to ask you, what you're out there looking at birds. What binoculars do you use? And not so much the brand, although that may be important as well. But if somebody was interested in looking at birds, what would you recommend? And then Laura and Harry, I'd like your opinions on the same subject. So John, please.
So, well, for hawk watching, of course, whenever you're looking at binoculars, there's two important numbers. And for example, my binoculars are 10 times 42. And what that relates to is the 10 is the amount of magnification. So it's magnified by 10 times. And then the 42 is actually in millimeters. So that's 4.2 centimeters. Sorry, we're going into metric. I know you Americans are a little...
you know, John, my favorite bumper sticker... My favorite bumper sticker, John, is if God had wanted us to use the metric system, he'd have given us 10 fingers.
So that's the width of your field of view. So for hawk watching, 10 by 42 is generally what the go-to pair of binoculars. If you're in the woods a lot, you really don't need that 10 times. Even 8 by 32s. Or something like 8x35, something like that will be quite sufficient. And that could even do, if that's what you've got and you come up to Hawk Ridge, you'll be just fine. But I mean, when you're looking through binoculars every day, month after month, you kind of get a little bit more particular. And you don't have, you know, people say, well, how much are your binoculars? And you tell them and they sit down for a moment to sort of gather their... you know, collect themselves. You don't have to spend an absorbent amount of money. The money is in the glass. It's the quality of the glass. It's the clarity. But, you know, for a few hundred dollars, there's some Vortex. There's some other brands that are really good binoculars. So you don't have to go for those, you know, $2,000 German, Austrian binoculars. But if you want to, you're going to get a great pair of binoculars. But,
for hawk, you say for hawks, 10 by 42 is a good number.
It is for me. Maybe Laura, you used to count. So what would you recommend?
Well, when I was counting, had Zeiss 10 by 40s, and those I actually paid for, and somebody borrowed them and never gave them back.
Laura?
Huh?
It wasn't me, was it?
No. But I still have very expensive binoculars, but it's because I got them as a gift. I always say never spend more on a pair of binoculars than you can comfortably afford to spend to replace them if something bad happens. Most of the expensive ones do have very good warranties, but so do many of the less expensive ones. But if you're going to be afraid to wear them because they're so expensive when you're going kayaking or canoeing where you could go right under a bald eagle nest, they were not worth that much money if you can't wear them to have this wonderful experience. They're not worth it if you're afraid to wear them when you're biking. And so spend what you can comfortably afford. The second number that John talked about, 10x42, that second number, that number of millimeters across on the objective lens tells you, A, how heavy the binoculars are, and the heavier they are, the harder it is when you have a sprained wrist or stuff like that. But also the higher the magnification, the harder to hold steady because the movement is magnified as much as the bird is. Also, the higher the magnification, the smaller your field of view for the exact same size binoculars. And that means that if you're looking for the warbler in the middle of the tree and you're not really good at pulling up the binoculars on them, you would have been better off with 7 or 8 power than 10 power because you'll have more of the tree and a better chance that the bird will be in there. The bigger like if you had 7x35s, you're going to see more hawks in that kettle at once than you are with the 10 power. With the 10 power, you could identify them. They'll appear closer. but also the less expensive binoculars, you're better off with lower power. If you're spending exactly $200 and you can't go over it, you're looking at the same company's binoculars, the 7 power will have better optics than the 10 power, because that's part of what you're paying for. So there's so many trade-offs. If you're shivering because you're counting and it's 30 below on the Christmas bird count, 7 power is going to hold steady a little better than 10 power. So it's not a simple get this, it's the best, because the best differs even for people with expensive binoculars. The best can change depending on conditions.
What I would also add too is if you're out and about and you're seeing people with binoculars, or you're sharing an experience and there's people there with binoculars, just say, hey, what have you got? And would you mind if I look through your optics? Because that way you get a free test. You can, is it too heavy? Is it too light? Because sometimes it's personal fit. Some people like Mercedes, some people like BMWs. It just depends. So if you get the opportunity to try a pair out, by all means, do that.
Yeah, you can't do that during COVID, but normally, yes. And the same with birding festivals. A lot of the companies that sell a range of binoculars will let you try them out in the field at big birding festivals. So that's another great opportunity. But like yesterday when I went out birding, I lucked out because I ran into a birder from the Twin Cities and we birded together all morning. But we stayed 6 feet apart. And the one time we were in too small of a place to do that, and we were both looking at the same birds, I have one of these things, so I just pulled it up. Because I have to be very careful with COVID, because I had a heart attack in January and I'm an old lady now. So, and then my daughter's living with us and her baby is due at any moment.
Ooh.
So I'll be a grandma, but I have to be very careful about nasty viruses because of that too.
Yeah. Harry?
Yeah.
What's your choice?
My two favorite birders are in Duluth. That's Laura and Jan Green. Jan Green, I did a lot, got kind of running in the same circles as Jan. And I asked her, I said, yeah, I want to get a new pair of binoculars. And she said, she told me right away what ones to get. And Jan's a longtime birder. You may have heard her on this show before, but we've just stayed in touch over the years. And when I go to Duluth, I often make sure that she's giving a presentation or something. So anyways, I listen to her and Laura and hear what other birders are finding. And what right now I have a pretty extreme neurological disease, so I can't hold high powered binoculars. And so that's another consideration. What kind of problems might you have, especially as you get older, with like Laura was mentioning, with shaking or anything like that? Then you need to have a much wider field to find that bird. When I was younger, I could ride my bike with my little 25 or so smaller field of view binoculars. But I rarely use those anymore because I can't find the darn bird in those little small field of view binoculars.
Well, I would add this. I need a pair because I'm not only a bird watcher, but I also look at butterflies and dragonflies. I need a pair that focus from about 6 to 8 feet all the way out to infinity. And I look at how much light transmission there is. Now, Laura, I went with a cheap pair. I've got a pair of waterproof Pentax 8x42. And you know what? I beat them up. I throw them around. They're laying on my car seat right now, unprotected. And at some point, I'll just go out and buy another set. But that particular one has great light transmission. It focuses down to 8 feet. And for my use, you know, and I like your take on it. You know, if they cost so much, you don't dare wear them. These are the prize jewels. I'm leaving these home. They're useless. You might as well have something you can bang around with.
And that 8x42, the second number, the old rule used to be always make that second number at least five times what the first number is. And my very first, my first 10 power binoculars weren't 10x42, they were 10x50s. Ooh. And because that lets in enough light. And so 8x42, that's even better than that. We don't have the rule that the second number needs to be five times greater anymore, because with the expensive lines, the glass is superior and the coatings on the glass, which are where a lot of your money is going to, is on those coatings. But if you're not paying thousands of dollars, and they really do, the most expensive ones now start at a couple thousand dollars and go up. But if you're spending hundreds or even 50s of dollars on your binoculars, the bigger the second number is relative to the first number, 8x42 is a perfect example of giving you lots of light.
All right.
And
well,
you also want lots of light in the woods where
absolutely.
It can be pretty dark.
Yeah, and early mornings, late evenings. It's always important to have light gathering. We talked about binoculars. Now I want to hear about birds. So let's go around. I want to hear a couple of your favorite birds and why they happen to rise to the top of the list. Laura, I'm going to let you go last because I already know you. I know your answer. Let's start with John.
Oh, it's always kind of like, what's your favorite song?
And who's your favorite kid?
People always say it's whatever bird I'm looking at. I'm not going to steal Laura's thunder, but I really do like the chickadees. I really do. They're so hardy. They're intelligent. They're social, gregarious, and tough. I just love them. But if we were to go with hawks and Hawkridge, I really do like the Merlins, which is a small, medium-sized falcon that breed in many cities in Duluth. They're more of an urban falcon, extremely fast, quite noisy, and they're really great to watch at Hawkridge in the fall. They chase anything. They're kind of got that hummingbird personality where they don't even think about it. If something moves, they just chase after it. And you see these Merlins chasing after chimney swifts and other hawks and other falcons. It's a lot of fun. Another one, if we go with the owls, you can't help but love the northern saw-whet owl, which is the small little owl that is we see, well, we don't always see a lot, but they're out there. We do band a great deal of saw-whet owls, and they are quite adorable. We see them a lot in Duluth because saw-whet owls, their migration route is generally the same every year. They're very consistent in where they migrate, and we should hopefully see a lot of saw-whet owls this year if, based on Whitefish Point, which is out in Michigan, they banned saw-whet owls earlier in the year, and they're banding hundreds of juvenile saw-whet owls right now. So if that holds true over this way, we should see a great deal of saw-whet owls. And how can you not love a saw-whet owl?
Oh, yeah. Harry showed me the first saw-whet owl I ever saw, and it was a pair and their offspring sitting on some balsam branches. You know, speaking of Merlins, I had, really quickly, I had a Merlin chasing a pileated or pileated woodpecker in my yard. And the woodpecker was like just annoyed. He wasn't frightened. He was just annoyed. And he would be on the tree and the bird would make a pass and he'd hop around to the other side of the tree. And it was hilarious.
I'm sure, Laura, if you were down at Park Point yesterday, there's by the ball fields there, there's a pair of merlins nesting. And I was down there the day previous, and those merlins must be exhausted. They've got young ones that are following them, begging for food. There was a juvenile peregrine that it was attacking. There was a bald eagle that they were attacking. I mean, it's an exhausting time of year, I think, for a lot of birds. But that
I didn't see them yesterday.
Oh, okay. But well, maybe just needed a day off.
They just were kind of moving around a little bit. But the very first swear words I ever heard a chickadee saying were at a saw-whet owl. So there is somebody who doesn't think they're cute and adorable. Just thought I'd throw that.
All right. Let's go to Harry. Laura, I'm going to let you go last on this one. Harry, what birds are you fond
John,
of?
John, I think you know mine too, but certainly Clark's Nutcracker and any jay is probably close to my heart. Those birds, you know, I just got a chance to really learn about how to do research through them as well, and that carried me a long way in my career. But the biggest thing I think is those nutcrackers. I'll tell you one little quick vignette to give you an idea how clever they are. Not only do they have a fantastic memory, better than anything else out there, I was watching one, my friend of mine was banding them, Steve Vanderwall, and who did a lot of research on them, and we were banding them, and we had the mist nets up, and the darn thing, you know, we were trying to catch nutcrackers, not other birds, and so what the nutcracker did was chase another bird, and when it got to the mist net, it just quickly went up about a foot or less and just over it, and then the other birds got stuck in the mist net, and the nutcracker was like, hey, I showed you guys, you're never going to catch me. It was so hard to catch them, even in things like mist nets. So, but, I remember climbing up to nests and checking them out and just watching all the hours I put in watching them. I never got bored. And those things had so many clever little habits about them. And I can't wait. And as you saw, John, I showed you my study sites. Some of the most beautiful country in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Laura.
Well,
sing the praises.
Knows, I use the, if I were stranded on a desert island, what bird would I most want to be stranded with? And it's definitely the black-capped chickadee. But I throw in blue jays with them, too. They're birds that pay attention to you. They look you in the eye, and you can establish a relationship with them. Plus, you could see them no matter what the weather is on that desert island. But the other thing, birds that I've discovered during COVID that I really love, and I was just so thrilled having them nesting near my yard, were brown thrashers.
I got
some really nice recordings of them singing the spring, and I was just thrilled. And the other one is the red-eyed vireo. Because they sing all day. Brown thrashers sing right up until the moment they attract a mate, and then they shut up. It was fun talking to Don Kreutzma about that. He did a lot of studies on brown thrashers, and he said he was all set up recording, and he'd gotten all these songs, and he was going to keep, he had enough recording time to go hours more, and a female flew in, and that was that.
You know, Laura, I love that brown thrasher too. It made me have a different idea of the color brown. I never thought of it as being beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's so rich.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, all right, Heidi.
Yes.
Brown Thrasher, are you going to vote for somebody else?
Yeah,
have you
like
got
the
others?
Thrashers. No, I'm going to vote for them.
All right, and just in the the fairness and all, my favorite bird is the raven. I'm a raven guy. Yep.
Wouldn't be bad to be stuck on a desert island with either.
No, and I'm
brown
pretty
thrashers would shut up if they found a mate.
Yeah,
you wouldn't want them to be unhappy. So
the raven would keep talking. You'd be like, "Shut up already! I've had enough." No, I've got more to say. Oh, this has been delightful. I wanted to ask you specifically, and Laura, you can chime in on this too. Golden eagles, I get a lot of people who are, let's say, inexperienced, who oftentimes tell me they have seen a golden eagle. And I tell them that based on probability, 99 out of 100 that you see are probably immature bald eagles. John, I know that you guys get golden eagles on the Hawk Ridge every year. Talk a little bit about that, and maybe talk a little bit about some of the, besides the golden eagle, what are some of the real rare birds that come by that we don't often associate with this area?
Well, I'll start with your last question because it just came to my head. I remember last year, we were 3 days into the count. I think it was about the 18th of August, and a black vulture came up over the ridge out in front of us coming down the shore. It never came over. It went back up the shore. But a black vulture is a southern species of vulture, which does seem to be moving up north a little bit more. But that's a rare one. I mean, there's probably only a handful of records, and it may be something that we may see more in the future. There are a couple of Western species that have shown up before: prairie falcon, ferruginous hawk. But they're really quite rare. But you just never know. There are some southern birds that are showing up in places like Illinois and Wisconsin, such as a swallowtail kite. And it looks kind of like a big swallow. It's got a big long forked tail, very agile. And I'm rubbing my hands and hoping that maybe this year we'll get that. But we'll see. But in terms of the golden eagle, yes, we do get a lot of, I saw 12 golden eagles yesterday. Chances are they probably didn't. We get Duluth is a great place to watch golden eagles, but really only during migration in the spring and in the fall. They're not really stopping here. You may see the odd one in wintertime, but very rare. These golden eagles generally going way up north, up into Canada, and the winter down in places like the Ozarks or even just southern Minnesota along Houston County, the big bluff areas. What I always tell people, and I have to do things in layman's terms for myself because I'm not particularly smart, but I always say, if it's got white armpits, it's never a golden eagle. An adult golden eagle is always all brown. The adult bald eagle obviously has the white head, white tail. When you get into the younger birds, that's where it gets a little bit more tricky. But if it's got white armpits, it's always going to be a bald eagle, because the young golden eagles, they have more of a white patch on the wrist. And, you could go online or look in your field guide. And generally, you're not really going to see them until October. So if you're seeing a few golden eagles in September, you got to be a little bit more careful, because chances are it's probably young bald eagles. But I must say, it's not always the easiest, and we all get fooled, especially looking at birds from a distance. So so that's kind of my take on it. But it is a great place to see golden eagles in October, for sure. And I should say, really quickly, Frank Nicoletti, who's our bander, he banded a golden eagle in 2012, and they put a radio transmitter on it. This bird migrated up to Great Slave Lake area up in Saskatchewan. And for 4 years, they were able to track its migration through Duluth all the way down to sort of Missouri, the Ozark regions. And it did that same trip for 4 years straight. And they just found this individual deceased this spring up in Saskatchewan. The radio transmitter only worked for 4 years and then it went dead. But that bird went back and forth between right through Duluth each year. So that was, and you can actually go on our Facebook page and there's an article about it, and it shows the map and it shows exactly where that bird went back and forth. And its name was Jack. So it's a really great golden eagle story. So it's one of the sort of the research things that we do there at Hawk Ridge.
Yeah. Laura, a few minutes left. You got a story about hawks or about migration?
I was going to say that right now in mid through late August is when Mississippi kites sometimes come through. And they're another one that's going for those dragonflies and stuff. And I used to be the hawk counter for a few falls in August, from August 15th to September 1st. And then at the time, Frank Nicoletti was our migrant worker and the official counter who would come and take over September 1st. And the only time a Mississippi kite showed up on my watch, it was after Frank got there and pointed it out to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, those can be coming through. Watch the skies, the nighthawks in the late afternoon. I used to see them all the time during my children's soccer games because they would fly over those open fields. I almost missed my son's first goal. And if my husband hadn't gone like this, I would have missed it. They're hunting before they make their flight. And I think what they're doing is working their way up into the sky, and they don't just stop at when it gets dark. They're too high up to see, and they're migrating more focused on distance at that point. But I saw one of my biggest flights ever was on my father-in-law's birthday when we were driving home from Port Wing, Wisconsin, and that was August 14th. Huh? So they can be, we start getting flights in early August and they peak at the end of the month, but it's so fun to watch. Have your hummingbird feeders out and have them clean so that your birds are getting good food on their way through. And enjoy them.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, John. Harry, final words?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention was that we're keeping track of so well now of all these birds, whether they're big or small. For example, John and I have had a guest on, Taza Shaming from over in New York and Cornell, and she has put small little solar-powered transmitters on Clark's Nutcrackers, for example, and the battery never wears down because it's solar-powered. So these little bands that and little harnesses she puts on the birds with the band or with the transmitter on there is really something else. And we're starting to learn with these small birds go a long distance and just the things that happens to them and what we're learning is just amazing.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining us this morning and for talking so eloquently about birds, about Hawk Ridge. It's been a delightful morning. We got an email from a longtime friend of ours who lives in Kansas City, is up here on vacation and discovered our conversation and is enthralled, and I can only thank you all for making that possible.
And if you want more information on Hawk Ridge, go to hawkridge.org and lauraerickson.com. You can also find out more about Laura. Are you still doing your Zoom bird meetings?
Yeah, the 1st of September, my Zoom talk will be about the different ways different birds migrate.
Okay, great. And that's Harry Hutchins, longtime co-host of A Talk on the Wild Side. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.